one of these days I'm going to use the entire stage. And Tom's going to have to follow me on the camera, and it's just going to be a fun little morning for all of us. So, good morning again. Does anybody else's eyes hurt a little bit looking at the screen? It feels like it's almost too much. That one's actually almost about perfect now, I think. But. So Betty Green was fascinated with planes. And I don't know, maybe several kids that age and that kind of thing were just fascinated with planes, especially right before the Great Depression, kind of leading into the Great Depression, but planes were getting more and more popular and those kind of things. I think they were probably getting a little bit more interesting, especially for kids, but Betty's fascination didn't ever wane. In fact, she went and visited when Charles Lindbergh came back from one of his flights and was a part of the crowd that welcomed him home. She watched pilots such as Richard Byrd, Burnt Balchin, and even Amelia Earhart. And so she just was fascinated with it. She would read whatever she could. She got connected with that world in whatever way she could. In fact, by the age she was 16, she was learning to fly a plane on her own. And I don't even know if I trust a lot of 16-year-olds driving a car right now, so I don't know. But she was learning to fly and flying solo by the time she was 16. Unfortunately, like I said, at that time, the 1930s or so, there weren't a lot of opportunities for women pilots. But for her, kind of fortunately, I guess, to a certain extent, there was something called World War II that was also starting to come into the picture while she was kind of coming of age, around 20 years old or so, and she was starting to get connected with that world. And so she looked for these opportunities to start to fly, to be a pilot. Again, there weren't a lot of careers or opportunities for a woman at that time, especially being a pilot. And so instead of kind of following the path that her mom kind of encouraged her and a lot of women followed at that time, she decided, I'm going to find another way. And in fact, the military, while World War II was going on, offered something called Women's Flying Training Detachment. And as Betty was preparing to kind of participate in this, they were called WASP. The ladies were called WASP. She started to wrestle with how this looked in her world, and she really had two passions. So flying was certainly one of them, but another one was to actually be a missionary, to serve God in some way. In fact, her older brother, Albert, was in China at the same time as Eric Little. If you guys were here a few weeks ago when we talked about him, her brother was over there in China at the same time Eric Little does. And so she was really just fascinated with the whole world of missions as well. And so these two passions, she wondered if she could bring them together. And so what she ended up doing before she ended up joining the military was talking to her friend, actually a family friend, a 70-year-old Mrs. Bowman. And I love Mrs. Bowman's advice for her. She said, I always think God plants his desires in our hearts so that we will act on them. I always think God plants his desires in our hearts so we will act on them. And we'll talk about that more in just a little bit as far as what that looks like, I think, theologically and biblically. But Betty really took that to heart. And so she put that as kind of her main goal in life. How can she put these two passions of flying as well as being a missionary and serving God that way together? But instead of kind of jumping on the boat and start to follow that passion and that desire in her life, again, she found an opportunity to at least fulfill one. So she went and joined, again, the military and this women's flying training detachment, which was really a volunteer role, which I think is fascinating because she did a lot of the same things that several of the men did in the military, but she had to pay them for room and board because women weren't allowed in the military at that time and that sort of thing. And so she's volunteering and being a part of this and willing to serve in whatever way she can. And basically what women, especially in the military at that time, did, they would fly things around more domestically. They would fly, maybe supplies and different things like that. They would actually fly these big targets behind their plane so that the anti-aircraft gunnery could practice shoot. And they were supposed to aim at the target that was flying behind them. There was at least one time where Betty's plane itself was getting shot at, which she was okay, but just apparently they let the rookie shoot the gun there, and he wasn't a very good aim or something, I don't know. But so Betty is participating in this military effort to help support the Americans, as they entered into World War II, doing, again, a variety of jobs, and she ended up being able to get a lot of experience through that, being able to learn to fly different planes, get a log a lot of different hours and that kind of thing. But one thing she did was not related to this while she was in the military, was she wrote this little article. And she sent this article about why she was a pilot, why, you know, as a woman especially, why she enjoyed doing it, what her goal in life was as far as being a missionary pilot, those kind of things. And she submitted it to this magazine called Power, which is a teen magazine, teen Christian magazine at that time from Scripture Union Press. And so she sends this article out, again, continuing her work in the military. Several other pilots take notice of this article. And so as she's working through this, several pilots were forming this group that have been praying over a year of how they can get this group started and going, contact her and say, we're starting this organization. We've been praying about it for a long time. We're going to call it the Christian Airmen's Missionary Fellowship, or which later became Missionary Aviation Fellowship, or MAF, and just said, were you interested in joining us? And she was. She was excited. She thought, this was exactly what I want to do. It's flying. It's mission work. It's exactly where my passion was and what I want to do. Problem was, is even though she was volunteer and could have quit the military at any time without any, you know, discharge issues or anything, she chose to finish her. She said, I'm going to finish my time in the military, and then I'll join in. But it wasn't long after that, within a couple months, that Betty received news that they were disbanding the WASP and disbanding this organization. And so, in fact, they were basically just kind of dumping these ladies and say, okay, we've got it, the war's turned the tide, and we don't really need you anymore, you can just go. And so shortly after she got word, everything seemed to just fall into place for her. She's able to join this organization. The problem was that she joined MAF, Missionary Aviation Fellowship. They had several pilots, but they had no planes, which is kind of important when you're doing this. And then they also didn't have any jobs. But if you don't have a plane, it's hard to get jobs, I guess, too. It's kind of like a taxi driver, not having a taxi, and then you can't have fare. Anyway, so she joins the organization. So her first role is basically, she gets hired full-time to do a lot of administrative work and doing a lot of different things that way. And so she starts to organize some of their bylaw kind of things and start to contact a lot of different organizations, churches, that kind of thing, to kind of get to start to build support. And then she gets contacted, or they get contacted, by an organization that we talked about last week, the Wycliffe Bible Translators, run by or started by Cameron Townsend. And so Cameron Townsend, again, we talked about like last week, really wanted to push further into these jungles and more remote locations in Central and South America. And to do that, they needed pilots, they needed planes. And so Townsend and Wycliffe Bible Translators contacts this MAF and Betty Green to try to get moving forward with how would this look, how can we make this work, and we can move translators closer to these indigenous people so that we can translate the Bibles, our New Testament especially, into these indigenous languages like we talked about last week. And so with these two missions coming together, finally they have a purpose and they have a job. They still have no plane, which again causes some problems. And so they put together, try to raise some funds. Wycliffe donates a significant amount, and they're able to find and buy this plane. And so Betty heads down. She ends up being the first pilot to be able to go down and be a part of this. Heads down with the Townsend Group, Wycliffe's translators, and starts flying people around in various ways. And some of it, again, is bringing missionaries deeper into the jungle rather than having to trek for several days, 3, 4, 5 days or whatever or more. They're able to fly there within an hour or less. And so she begins that work in Central and South America with them. The problem is as they're down there, another pilot later joins Betty down there, and he ends up crashing the plane. He ends up causing a significant amount of damage. And the only reason I really mention that crash is because they bring another individual into the story named Nate Saint. And maybe if you remember a few years ago, I think I did a message on Nate Saint, and he's just a fascinating person. He's the pilot that ended up taking the five men down into the Akua tribe. And if you've seen like the movie End of the Spear, or remember what I talked about, that was the group of five men that was going into this group of really savage people who would almost just kill you on sight. And that's basically what they did. They killed these five missionaries on sight, Nate Saint, Jim Elliott, and some others that were a part of that group. And so all these, to me, and I'm a little more connected to that world, all these people in this world are coming together at this point and accomplishing some amazing things. But Nate Sane is the mechanic and the pilot who comes and fixes one of their planes for them as they continue their work. But as they deal with all these issues, Betty ends up moving down and getting another plane and going further south to Peru. And in Peru, that's really Betty's first brush with death. At one point in time, she's flying this plane, and when she brings it in, the other pilot with her and the mechanic notice something's not quite right, and so they check it and figure it out. They can't fix it quick, and so the mechanic tells Betty, "You can't fly this plane unless it's emergency, unless you absolutely have to, until I get it fixed." And so he begins working on it, but then all of a sudden he's called away for a family emergency, and so this mechanic who's been working on this plane again reminds her, "Don't fly it unless you absolutely have to." Well, then of course there's an emergency that comes up, or something kind of like an emergency it seems like, where these pilots go down and they are lost from another organization. But Betty's like, well, I could go and I could search for them. I'm the closest to them, but there are other groups that could come and help search for them as well. And so, is this really an emergency? And I think we've all probably dealt with that. Is this really an emergency? And I've told my kids that all the time too. Is that really an emergency? If no one's bleeding, it's okay. Usually. But anyway, these pilots are lost and they don't know where they are. And so Betty's like, well, I need to go search for him. And so she gets in this plane, takes off, and it works perfectly for the first night, the first few hours that she's flying. She couldn't find him, returns back to base for the night, says, I'll resume in the morning. And so in the morning, they get up, they go, and again, the plane seems to be working perfectly for a couple hours. And then all of a sudden, the engines just stop, just completely shut off, and there's silence. She looks around her, and she's in one of those planes that I forget what they're called. Some of you might know, but you can land them on water as well as just, normal airstrip. And she's looking around for anywhere to land. But all around her is trees, so she can't find anywhere to land. So she keeps trying to get it started, and I don't think you turn a key, but that's what I'm going to pretend she does. She tries to get it started, and she's just not able to because, this mechanic said it was having troubles. And finally, she hits it one last time, and it fires up for just 20 seconds. But she climbs as high as she can to get as much altitude and as much distance as possible. And she's able to get, again, just 20 seconds out of it. Then as it dies again, as they start coming down, she's able to see a body of water where she can actually safely land the plane. And so she lands it safely. They get it all brought back into their base and everything like that. And the mechanic who had to take off finally comes back to look at this plane, and he looks it over and he says, obviously I have no idea what parts it is and all that kind of stuff, but whatever part it was missing and broken, when it stopped the first time, it should never have started again the way it was broken. And so he was just in awe or shocked of how could it start up for 20 more seconds to get her to land safely. And so again, looking at this as obviously a miraculous event for her to be able to be saved, as well as the people that were helping her search. And so Betty spends a couple years pioneering the mission field down there in Central and South America, returns home for a while, is able to kind of do some things as far as participate in some classes and different things like that before she's again brought overseas. But this time she ends up in Nigeria, in Africa. And so she ends over to in Nigeria. And one of the interesting things about Nigeria, especially at that time, this is getting, I want to say in the 50s or 60s maybe, but... It looks exactly like you might expect an Arabian night to look like. Everything's exactly like that. The camels moving through, and she goes and she's able to visit a sultan, which is kind of crazy for a woman to be able to go into that presence of a sultan. And it's exactly like she expected. In fact, she didn't say this, but I expected him to be stroking a tiger next to him as he was talking to her. But that's just in my. Eventually, maybe one day I'll have a tiger that I'll. No, I won't. Okay. So she goes and she visits the sultan, and again, it's kind of a minor thing maybe, but it's just such a unique opportunity for a woman in that culture at that time to be able to interact with him in that way. In fact, she's in Nigeria for a while and able to do several things there, and she sees some of the discrepancy in the Muslim culture, because that's a Muslim culture at that time, between the men and the women and how women are treated. In fact, she sees and spends a little bit of time with the women and the concubines of the sultan, and sees how they're basically slaves. They're not able to leave a certain area of the palace or whatever they live in, and they basically kind of live there just to serve him. And she sees that in different ways, but she's also end up a few years later in Sudan. And it's the same way in the Sudanese culture. It's the men are you know, such a prominent place compared to women, that she sees all this discrepancy and all this pain. And even at that time, I mean, we can remember, or you think back maybe in the 50s, 60s in America, even the discrepancy between genders even still at that time. But that world was just so different for her. But she, again, was given these unique opportunities. In Sudan, women weren't actually able to fly in Sudanese airspace. And so when they asked her to come over, I think it was a different section of MAF, I think it was the United Kingdom division, asked her to come to Sudan. She shouldn't have been able to fly in their airspace, but somehow she's able to get special permission as a woman to be able to go and fly in this in Sudan and help out the missionary work there as well. Again, another unique relationship she has there. She is able to, at one point in time, have a lunch with these government officials. These male government officials are inviting her to share a lunch with her and be able to talk about what she does and why she does it and those kind of things. And so I think, as much as her mission work was involved with ferrying people around, supplies, or giving people where they needed to go and helping people and speeding up the missionary process in so many ways and getting access to places that weren't very accessible before, I think she still has another mission opportunity where she speaks to these people and be able to share about where she is and where she's coming from and why she does what she does. And so she's just, again, a kind of a unique perspective in terms of mission work. She doesn't do the traditional, I'm going to stand up and I'm going to preach, or I'm going to start a church, or I'm going to do these things. She's a much more of a support role as far as, you know, carrying things back and forth, but she's also able to do her own work as well and sharing her work and what she does as well. But one other unique relationship that she built was with another individual, an air traffic controller in Sudan. She was on one trip where she was flying a family back to England. At one point, it was a 4,000-mile journey. As she was ready to leave, this air traffic controller talks to her and says, we'll be keeping track of your journey, close track of your journey. And basically, it sounded like he was just saying, good luck, we hope you make it okay. But as she gets going, it's the first 1,200 miles, they are getting ready to stop for refueling. And as they get closer and closer, she starts radioing in, are we clear to land, are we clear to land? And no one's responding. She's not getting anything back from the where she's landed, the city that she was going to land in. And the more she tries, and the longer it takes, the more worried she gets. Then all of a sudden, she hears this voice come on the radio, and it's the air traffic controller 1,200 miles back in Sudan saying, we've got your message, we'll relay it forward. And so the Sudanese air traffic controller forwards this message, and finally she hears back from where she's supposed to land and able to land and refuel safely. And again, just a unique relationship and opportunity that this, 1,200 miles, this air traffic controller is keeping track of where she's at and what she's doing to be able to help out in a time where she's maybe struggling a little bit. And so again, Betty spends time in Sudan for a while. She comes back home again for a while, but then she ends up in New Guinea, island by Australia. And there she's able to do a little bit more of the primitive beginnings of a mission work, because at that time, especially, New Guinea wasn't very, there weren't very many missionaries, and they were just starting to kind of get a presence in that area. And so she was able to go, and she was be a part of it. One of the neat journeys that she has is she volunteered to go check out this newly built airstrip, which is basically they chop down trees and stuff and able to clear off. Basically, it's just smoothing it out kind of a thing. And so she's traveling to go check it out. Well, obviously at that time in the jungle there, she's going to have to go through, and there's going through trees and around different areas. There's rope bridges, which kind of freak her out, and I would imagine freak me out too. You got a rope. I think you're walking on your feet and holding on to a rope. And so she's the one that kind of volunteers to do this 2-3 day journey up into this, check this out. And there are times where she, pauses and has to contemplate what she's doing, but she's able to make it and accomplish, again, that. And when they get that, approved and fixed and ready to go, it obviously incredibly hurries up the process. She said 3 days it took her to travel up to this, remote missionary base, and it took a plane an hour kind of a thing. And so just the speed and comfort and different things that a pilot accomplishes in that world. As Betty leaves New Guinea and returns home, she never gets a chance to leave again. I think she does some more, some little flights and stuff here and there, but she eventually gets dementia, Alzheimer's, and she ends up passing away in 1998, which I was going to say isn't that long ago, but it's more than 20 years ago, so seems like it wasn't that long ago. All right, so Betty is just this amazing person, I think, in so many ways. And again, I don't relate to her story as much as some of the others we've talked about. But one of the things that just sticks out to me were the words given to Betty at that time from Mrs. Bowman when she was first starting out. And if, just remember, the words were, "I always think God plants his desires in our hearts so we will act on them." I think God always plants, or God plants his desires in our hearts so we will act on them. And I would agree that that's really good advice, and we'll talk a little bit more about what that means theologically in just a second. But to me, looking at in terms of God's great rescue plan, I think God does give us either passions or desires or something to be able to get us down a path where he wants us to go down. And so, again, looking at that as holistic as day, and as far as, again, thinking of God's great rescue plan, which I'm going to use God's great rescue plan as an image for probably years to come, but because I just think it's such a great image to hold on to. And so, as we move forward, as life moves beyond the biblical text, we look at someone's life like Betty's, or we look at our own lives, and we think, how does God want us to pursue where we're at and where we're going? And again, I think this is a part of that story. And the problem is, as I looked at the biblical text, I don't think there's a clear text that says, follow your passions and desires, right? I mean, there's some Psalms and there's some Proverbs that point to that a little bit. But there's also not a text that says, don't do that, right? So I think there's some leeway in there as far as that goes. But to guide our thought process, there's two texts I wanted to look at. First is Ephesians 2:8 through 10. And Paul writes for us there, he says, "For by grace you have been saved through faith. And this is not your own doing, it is a gift of God, not a result of works so that no one can boast, for we are his workmanship, created in Christ Jesus for good works, which God prepared beforehand that we should walk in them." And I hope you're familiar with those verses. I think they're probably one of the most succinct, wonderful verses in the whole Bible that point to how we come to faith and how we come to salvation in Jesus. And so just as far as context goes, what he's talking about here as far as restoring the relationship with God, like I mentioned in my communion meditation, is that restoration of that relationship we know only comes because of our faith in Jesus Christ. And then we can say that faith in Jesus Christ is then, the response to that is the good works that Jesus has prepared for us to do. Someone wrote it and put it this way. He said, good works are the result and consequence of God's new creative work. And so we do these things and we live them out because of that restored relationship with God. We don't do those things and then earn the relationship. I think that pattern is so important for us to keep clear. And I do want to point out that I think these verses are a little bit more general, right? God's work that he created for us to do may not be specific to each individual life necessarily, as much as he says, you know, Jesus gives us two very clear commandments, right? Love God with everything you've got and love others, because and they're tied together so closely. And then we see a definition of love in 1 Corinthians 13, where love is patient, love is kind, and those kind of things. And so, in general, I think Paul is saying, that's what you should do. Those are the good works that Jesus called us to. Love God, love others, and do it in such a way that it looks like patience and kindness and not rude and not boastful. But then, obviously, these general things have specific application within our lives. And so the way we express that, the way we talk about it, the way it comes out in our day-to-day life, will look different, right? The way I express love is going to be different than you know, a mother expresses love, or a kid expresses love, or different things like that, or, you know, someone that's, you know, a little bit older, a little bit younger than me, and different things. So it's going to be expressed differently, and the specifics are maybe where we live, or the specifics are where we live our lives. And I don't probably need to say this, but I think it's so important for us to keep that in mind, is that these are good works. Right, there are lots of passions and desires in our world that don't lead to good works. Right, they lead to hardship, they lead to sin, they lead to damaging relationships. And so, again, as we look at our passions and our desires, the things that we've been given, maybe those things we've had since we were two or three, or young, maybe even younger, but they need to produce something that's good and positive and fruitful, not something that's necessarily are going to cause problems. And so that brings me to my second verse in 1 Corinthians 10:31, which, again, just simply summarizes everything. It says, "So whether you eat or drink, or whatever you do, do all to the glory of God." And so in context, again, in 1 Corinthians 10, Paul is writing here and talking about food sacrifice to idols. And in that culture at that time, people would bring an offering, right? Even the Jewish culture, they'd bring an offering, and it'd be sacrificed, it'd be burnt and or cooked up and be a sacrifice for this god or in whatever way. And then they'd sell it. They'd kind of come around, they'd sell it to whoever wanted to buy, kind of a thing. And so in that culture at that time, Paul was writing to the people and saying, okay, what are you supposed to do about this? Can you eat the meat that was sacrificed to idols or not, or how do you do it? And I guess I would summarize what he's saying in 1 Corinthians 10 as saying, as long as you have a clear conscience about it, as long as you are comfortable with it honestly comfortable with it, then it's okay. There's nothing inherently wrong with eating food sacrificed to idols. The idea behind it again is how are we going to, what does it look like to other people? And he does warn and say, okay, if there's a weaker, you know, someone with a weaker faith, or if there's someone else that maybe struggles with it a little bit, maybe you need to watch that and, you know, don't eat the meat maybe if it's going to cause someone else to have problems. And I think of a lot of times in our culture, alcohol a lot of times, right? Personally, I don't, you know, have a big deal. I don't have an issue with, you know, with alcohol in general. I have a huge problem with it becoming an issue as far as something that we're dependent on, or something that, you know, we become intoxicated. And not even if the Bible didn't say don't get drunk, we know that we don't make good decisions. Well, I shouldn't say. I don't think a lot of people have made good decisions when they've been intoxicated. I personally haven't been there, so I always make good decisions. That's not true. But right, but anyway, just in keeping in general, you know, obviously alcohol, maybe, you know, if it's okay, if you feel comfortable, you have a clear conscience about drinking some, that's your choice and up to you. But maybe I would make choices that would be different than you would on that, just because I have a different conscience about it, or because of how I think other people would view it. And I don't know, I'll leave it up at that. I could probably go into more detail, but just thinking about, again, the things that we are passionate about, the things that we do desire, ultimately need to come down to the point of glory of God, to bring all things we do to the glory of God. And so that's really, I guess, my point with the passions and the desires, is it needs to lead down to a path that leads us down there. The thing is as we look at that and we think about that, just clearly, just following blindly our passions isn't always helpful either. I was actually reading an article that was saying don't follow your passions, because I can tell you from my age, and I know kids that people that are younger than me, we're told all the time, follow your passions, follow your dreams, follow your goals, and that's okay advice. But this article I was reading says don't do that, and I would just say that's true too. Don't just follow your desires. Don't just blindly say this is what I want and this is what I need to do. And I think we saw that with Betty too. Was she had this desire, I'm going to be a pilot, a missionary. So she could, as she came to you know, a certain point in her life, she could say, okay, I'm going to raise money, I'm going to do this, so that I can do exactly what my passion and desire is. And there wouldn't have been maybe anything wrong with that. But I think the way she came about it, she was willing to go down other paths and other routes, and able to get to a point where she was basically offered exactly what she wanted to be able to come to fruition for where she was at. And so that's more, I think, and what I would say and what this article says, it's not necessarily about just following your passions, it's about fulfilling your passions. And so I think there's a difference there in saying, okay, I'm going to seek that, I'm going to look out that, I'm going to try to do that, but it may not be one, you know, it may not be a straight line there, I guess. And I think of my own life when I think of that too, because I didn't say this probably ever before, maybe to you guys, but I didn't ever plan on being a youth minister. And I know I did that here for 4 years. And I loved it after I got here, and, you know, everything kind of started to work out. But that was never my goal, right? I didn't have a passion for youth, especially when I was in college and younger. I love kids, and I still don't think I'm cool enough to be just a youth junior high school pastor. I know I'm not cool enough, actually. But I love kids ministry, and that's something that I've really enjoyed being able to be a part of again. But again, my passion was to help and to serve and to love people. And you can do that in any role, I think, but my goal is always to be what I'm doing now, which is why I'm just so blessed to be here and be able to do the things I do, because this is my passion and my goals and what I want to do. It wasn't a straight line, right? I didn't graduate from college and I'm, you know, end up here in this position. It took years and weaving and bouncing and back and forth and all sorts of crazy stuff that I, you know, won't tell you about right now. But You know, but again, I feel like I've come to a point where I've been able to fulfill those things in a unique way, because I was willing to say, okay, this is my ultimate goal, but there are other things that need to happen in place. There are still responsibilities. You know, I still needed to, I could have sat and waited until I got exactly what I wanted, but I still had a family to take care of, right? There's still responsibilities we have. There's still things that we need to fulfill out. So a blind following of passions isn't the same thing as fulfilling those passions. And then I got to thinking, right, in our demographic, you know, several of us, or maybe most of us, aren't necessarily thinking about what our long-term passions are, like Betty was when she was 20. And so just thinking about where we're at and where you guys are at, whether you're, you know, whatever age, whatever spectrum, whatever situation, is continue to look those out. Because I think sometimes they get suppressed, they get pushed away, they get sidelined for whatever reason, and we say, okay, well, I'm too old for that now, or this isn't something that is helpful. But I think it's so important, and I think there's so much fulfillment. You can find contentment and peace, and should find contentment and peace no matter where we're at and what we're doing. But even if it's not a job, even if it's just something that's a sideline, is finding a way to be passionate about what, you know, to express what we're passionate about, but find a way to glorify God in it, right? And so whether it's a hobby that we think we do, you know, we do it every, you know, few days, or we do it on the weekends, or it's something that we do just, you know, on our own in the evenings or something, is how can I take that passion and desire and turn it into something, again, that brings glory to God? And it doesn't necessarily have to necessarily involve a whole lot of other people or anybody. I think we can bring glory to God if you just love to, I'm trying to think of something crazy, crafting. Is that crazy? No, probably not that crazy. But, you know, you just love to do something, and it's just for you and God, and that's something that you just express with Him. But I think there are also things that we can do that can involve other people. There was something in Bible college that we did, actually I think it was seminary that we did it, that the professor would bring up an idea or a kind of a case study and say, okay, what about this person? How can they live out their passions and desires in this world and glorify God with it? And we were supposed to kind of give up with ideas, but then she would throw roadblocks, and she'd say, well, what if they couldn't do this? And what if they couldn't do this? One example that we did in class, was this young lady that's passionate desire was to have her own kids. She was going to raise them on her, you know, and raise them to love God and glorify God with these kids. And then we would all say that's wonderful, right? We would say that that's a great great passion. But let's say then that that woman, for whatever reason, couldn't have her own kids, whether she couldn't find her own, you know, couldn't find a spouse, or she, you know, maybe she was infertile or something like that, and so she couldn't end up having her own kids. Well, what are some options for her then? Well, maybe she could adopt, right? Maybe she could foster kids. Well, maybe, let's say, because of financial reasons, they wouldn't let her, right? Or something happened that she couldn't foster or have kids in her home. Well, maybe then she'd be the best aunt in the world. Not aunt in the world. Just make that clear. And she would love those kids, and she would help raise them, basically show them who Jesus was, glorify God through those kids. And well, maybe she was a single child and didn't have those things, right? It's a fun game to play. We can throw all these things out. Well, maybe then she could invest in other kids, maybe community kids, maybe with a children's ministry at the church, or start mentoring kids and teach them about Jesus and all these kinds of things, and fulfilling a passion, a desire that she has. And the problem is, again, if we get so narrow-minded and say this is the way it has to be, then I think we can miss some opportunities that God maybe has for us. And I think that's what happened with Betty. I don't think Betty would have had the success and the effect and the impact that she had if she had said, I'm going to do this on my own, I'm going to make sure this accomplished, and I'm going to get it done no matter what. I think we do need to do that sometimes, and I think we need people in our world that do that. But as she allowed God to lead her down that path, things just fell into place for her. And it fell and accomplished those things. And so that's looking at her life and looking at where you're at. And I just hope you don't just kind of brush me off and say, oh, that's whatever, Matt, that's fine, but I'm past that. And, you know, this would be a great graduation speech for you, Matt. But you guys have, we have passions and we have desires. And I just pray that through them and somehow in some way you can find a way to invest those so that it brings glory to God, so that others can know about Jesus, so we can love God, we can love others through whatever way and things that we're passionate about. And again, that's one of the reasons that I love Betty Green's story, is because she followed that passion. It didn't lead her necessarily down the exact path that she wanted, but she was open to opportunities and was able to fall into a place that fit her perfectly. And so that's my prayer for you, because I don't know if you can tell, I have great contentment and peace and joy in what I do and finding a place I think that God has placed me. And I want that for all of you. In so many ways. And so that's my prayer, and that's what I offer to you this morning. So if you'll join me in prayer, we'll go from here. Gracious Father, you are a God that provides us passions and desires. I just pray that we can find ways to use them to glorify you, to lead us, guide us, and direct us to love you so that we can, and through that, loving others and loving others to love you and all the things that go in between there, Lord. And just help us to silk at those passions, those desires, those things we enjoy doing, and help us to bring them into your world so that you can be glorified in them. Help us to just reach out and to connect, find ways to just bring joy to this world through your name. And I pray this all in your Son Jesus' name. Amen. Worship team, you can fix my mess up.